Hi everyone, Davinia here, and this season of Let's Make It Rain, the podcast, is sponsored by PensionBee, an online pension provider who's on a mission to make pensions simple so that customers all over the UK can become pension confident and save for a happy retirement. PensionBee's website and app make it simple for customers to combine their old pension pots, contribute flexibly, and withdraw their pension money all in one place. PensionBee offers a range of pension plans for a range of different needs, whether you're self-employed or want to invest responsibly with a fossil fuel-free or impact investing plan. Head to PensionBee.com or download the app to get started and become pension confident. Remember, as with all investing, your capital is at risk. And speaking of investing, for lots of us, we didn't start learning about how to save, spend, and invest our money for the future until we were well into our adulthood. I wrote Cash is Queen to change that. Cash is Queen is the world's first financial literacy book written exclusively for preteen and teenage girls, equipping them with everything they need to build solid financial foundations long before they start their first jobs. Buy it for your daughters, your nieces, your granddaughters, your goddaughters, and even yourselves. Link in show notes to find out more. Enjoy the episode. Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers. Those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Nicola Sharp-Jeffs. Nicola is founder and CEO of leading economic abuse charity, Surviving Economic Abuse. Nicola, thank you so much for being here today. Can you introduce yourself for the benefit of the listeners?
Absolutely. And thank you so much for having me. So yeah, I founded the charity back in 2017. And it has grown so much in the last 6 years that I think it's really reflective of the need of the charity, really. And as it's grown, I went from being a one-woman band to the chief executive of a fantastic team of around 30.
Wow. My goodness, that really is testament to the need and I guess growing recognition of economic abuse and what it entails. And we'll get into some of that now. So there are two seemingly interchangeable terms used to describe this area of abuse, and it's known as either financial or economic abuse. Can you explain what it is for anyone that's unfamiliar, and I suppose what the difference is?
Yeah, absolutely. So financial abuse is in some ways a subset of economic abuse. So the common thing is the control of money and finances. So when it's purely the control of money and finances, it would be financial abuse. When it's the control of money and finances, plus the things that money can buy, like, for example, food, clothing, transport, a mobile phone, a laptop, it would be economic abuse. So it's about one person controlling someone else's ability to use those resources or acquire them or even maintain them in the way that they want to. So maybe if I just give some examples to break that down a little bit. So most people would probably think about kind of restrictive behaviours, so not being allowed access to a bank account, for example. With economic abuse, that would be, you know, not being allowed to use the car when you want to use it. It might be not being able to help yourself to food out of the fridge when you want to eat something. So it's all about restriction. And then we also see alongside that behaviours that are linked to exploitation. So that might be making someone perform a sexual favour, for example, in exchange for food or money. It might mean them working perhaps for a partner's business, but not being paid for working for that business. So exploitation in that way as well. And then we also see sabotage. So that's when a partner might, you know, cut their partner's clothes up so that they can't go to work. It could be them sabotaging their credit rating by exploiting them in another way through taking out debt in their name and then perhaps not letting them pay that money back. So it takes sort of lots of different forms. It might create dependency. You can see if you haven't got your own money and you're dependent on someone else. You can see how, you know, being forced into performing sexual favours, for example, means that you're dependent on doing things like that to get money to survive. It might be that you have access to money, but the perpetrator's taken out so much credit in your name that all your money goes on paying back those loans or credit cards, and you don't have any spare money. So your situation is really unstable. So really it's about control in lots of different ways that stops victims and survivors from behaving in the way that they want to, sort of limiting their freedoms and their ability to do things purely through the control of economic resources.
Wow. Gosh, even as you were talking, my heart was just slowly sinking with every additional statement you made about some of the ways it manifests itself. And of course, we know whilst economic abuse is not something that is unique to women by any means, we know that women tend to be disproportionately impacted. And of course, there are certain points in a woman's life where we might be especially vulnerable. And I think, you know, one of the things that occurred to me when, you know, because we have a very short section of one of the modules within the Rainmakers Academy on economic and financial abuse, just because I recognise that it's so important that, you know, when you think about talking to groups of women together, that even if, you know, it's not, of course, I'm not a qualified psychologist by any means or a therapist, and therefore able to offer psychological trauma-based remedies, it is important that as women we're able to understand what the red flags look like and, you know, identify or call it out, if not in our own situations, then perhaps with friends or family members. So of course lots of people think, well gosh, that's obvious, but it's that creeping insidious effect of this form of abuse, isn't it? You know, and you will know this better than I, in the ways that it might manifest itself in women's lives and almost, as I say, creep up on you without you even realizing it's happening. What are some of the ways you see it manifesting itself in the lives of some of the women you work with? And by that, I mean, obviously, you've shared very, very clearly, thank you for that, some of, you know, the examples of what it looks like. But in terms of how it creeps up on a woman, you know, are there any pinch points in a woman's life, perhaps after having a baby, perhaps after moving in with someone for the first time, and, you know, you've had that honeymoon period that might have prompted or compelled you to move in the first place, and then suddenly you find yourself subjected to behaviours that you were unprepared for. Are there any points that you think, or that you've identified patterns that you could say, actually, we see a concentration of or heightened abuse in these points in time in a woman's life?
I think so. So as you say, initially, it is really insidious behaviour. So you might be a financial expert and you might be very well versed in economic abuse, but that doesn't mean it can't happen to you. And that's because of the way it's introduced. So it might be presented as care. So you might meet somebody, you know, we have sort of romantic ideals. Someone might say, oh, you don't need to work. I earn enough for both of us. You know, why don't I look after you? And then you could do fun things with your time and not go to that office job that you hate. That's really caring, lovely behaviour. Who would not want someone perhaps to support them so they can go off and do fun things instead? And they might say, oh, look, you're so busy. You know, you're working full time. You're looking after the kids. You're looking after the house. You know, the money, the finances is something else to worry about. Don't worry. I'll look after it. You know, you don't need to concern yourself about it. Leave it to me and I'll sort things out. You know, so that again is, you know, very sort of caring behaviour, it feels, from the way it's being presented. And of course, that might not be the case, but you can see why you wouldn't necessarily question that. You know, it's somebody that you love, it's somebody that you trust. And then part of that kind of then starts to tap into some of the kind of gender-based roles, I guess. They might say, well, actually, you know, women aren't very good at looking after money, are they? Men are much better. You know, I'm the main breadwinner. Actually, it's better that I look after it because you're a woman. Or they might say, to your point about points in time, they might say something along the lines of, you know, we're a partnership now, we're one unit. You know, why would you need to have your own bank account? Look, we've moved in together, we've got a joint mortgage together. Why would you need your own bank account? That suggests to me that you're not committed to our relationship. So again, that might be another way. They might say, well, you know, now that we've got children, actually, you know, you'd be a better mum, actually, if you stayed at home, you know, and I can afford again to look after everybody, you know. So if you're going to be the best mum to our kids, well, I think you should give up work. So those kind of life moments or those kind of times in life where, you know, a perpetrator can kind of use the power that they have because, for example, they might be the main breadwinner to kind of bring these situations around in a way that's either caring or a sort of kind of playing into things that society tells women. And to your point a little bit earlier, you know, that's why women disproportionately will experience economic abuse kind of within the context of domestic abuse, because they lack often the same power, and that's what the abuser takes advantage of, you know, and in ways that, you know, are just seen, I say, in plain sight. We don't question a woman being at home and looking after the kids. We don't question a woman giving up her job when she gets married, but we probably do question it the other way around. So sometimes it's just been a bright, you know, if someone really loved their job and suddenly gave it up after they met someone, you know, as friends, we should probably be saying, oh, well, why is that? As opposed to just thinking, oh, yeah, well, that's what happens when someone meets someone who's got money, you know, and they're a woman, or women give up work when they have kids. You know, if someone really loves their work and their behaviour is out of character, then maybe we should start questioning that.
Absolutely. And so that kind of leads me on to my next question, really, because one of the things that I often think, particularly when it comes to economic abuse, is, you know, as I said at the start, men absolutely can also be subjected to this form of abuse. You know, if you think about some of the hallmarks of it, as you've said, which were around centered around control and coercion, of course, women can equally be perpetrators of that, but we still see women being disproportionately affected. And, you know, when you think about looking for changes in behaviour among people that we're closest to. So, for example, you know, a woman that loves her career or is particularly ambitious, suddenly shrinking and deciding that she doesn't love her career anymore and she wants to stay at home. And I think that lots of us, myself included, would probably be quite surprised by the types of women that might be affected by this form of abuse. I think it's similar to other types of domestic abuse where you might think, you know, actually, and perhaps disrespectfully in some ways, you might think, oh, it's associated with people that fit into certain categories, a certain socioeconomic group, for example, that work in certain types of industries or careers. And you think, you know, surely somebody that is, I don't know, a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant, surely with their level of education, professional qualifications, access to network, access to money, surely they wouldn't be affected by something like this. What would you say to people, including myself, that might hold some of those misconceptions about who would be affected? Because as you say, if it's hiding in plain sight and we're not looking, and of course, but, you know, you don't want to scrutinize your friends and think, oh, my God, like, are you suffering from abuse? But of course, if it's hiding in plain sight, there might be things that are right in front of your face that you ignore because you think, no, it couldn't be my best friend. It couldn't be my sister. Absolutely not. What would you say to those types of people?
I think it is those myths and stereotypes. So certainly, you know, I think I had my own moment, which I sort of look back on now and think, gosh, you know, I was sort of ignorant in lots of ways, I guess. But, you know, I think we do listen to what we hear society tell us. You know, I spoke to victims and survivors who were accessing domestic abuse services, and I just remember thinking one day, gosh, they're no different mm-hmm. to me.
Which is terrifying, yeah.
These are really, yeah, they're, you know, intelligent women. They've had fantastic careers. You know, but it's somebody else's behaviour and the impact that that has. And, you know, we've already talked about how insidiously that can be introduced. And unless you are knowledgeable about domestic abuse, and I think that's the difference, you know, you don't question those behaviours. You don't, I guess, think to protect yourself in some ways, I guess. If, you know, to go back to this example of, you know, if you don't give up your own bank account to this joint account, you know, there's something wrong with our relationship. It's about saying, well, actually, you know, a relationship is about two equals, and okay, we might have a joint bank account for bills for the house and to pay the rent or the mortgage, but actually, you know, you shouldn't be threatened or concerned by the fact that I also have my own independence. And actually, if someone, you know, doesn't want you to have your own independence, then that's a bit of a question mark to say, well, why is that the case? You know, why is someone seeking to sort of control, you know, my ability to kind of spend money the way I want to once we've met joint commitments, I guess. So it's really about kind of having that knowledge and that understanding of what domestic abuse is generally, and, you know, what those different behaviours might look like and why that might include economic abuse as well. And again, you know, to your point a little bit earlier, this piece about dependency, and, you know, as I said, we might kind of recognise that more. Again, a lot of victims and survivors I work with, have worked with, you know, have earned three-figure salaries, they've had investments, they own a lot of property, but the perpetrator's behaviour sabotages all those things that they do have, in the same way that a woman who doesn't have very much is kind of taken advantage of. So you know, I think we just have to sort of be mindful that it looks different for different people, and that perpetrators kind of recognise difference. You know, again, we were talking about the difference between men and women, but certainly when you start to think about intersecting inequalities, actually, you know, we would see more disabled women experiencing economic abuse than we would women who aren't disabled, for example. The more inequalities you experience that make up part of your identity, sadly, increases the risk, because, again, it's that kind of power that the perpetrator has over you, and like another way of abusing that power. So I was just thinking, I've been talking about the cost of living for a long time, and I was speaking to a survivor recently where the perpetrator wasn't letting her power her wheelchair because the cost of electricity was so much. So, you know, she couldn't actually move around because her wheelchair was powered by electricity. So you can start to see how abusers' tactics will kind of reflect the certain situation that the victim survivor finds themselves in. And that's why it's so important that we're kind of survivor-centred in our approach. So again, you know, just thinking of a woman in the financial services sector, for example, the perpetrator will know that she has to have a good credit rating to be able to work in the financial services sector. So they might take a load of debt out in her name, refuse to let her pay it, sabotages her credit rating, therefore sabotages her employment, and she loses her job, unless, you know, she's in a fantastic workplace which is very clued up about domestic abuse, where she feels able to share that that's happened, and they might work outside of policy, which, you know, in the rare occasion I've been known to happen. Abusers know what impact they have, and they use their tactics and shape them accordingly. And, you know, women who operate in spaces where there is a lot of resource might not present in the same way. So again, I was quite surprised when I set surviving economic abuse up, because I was used to working in community services where victims and survivors didn't really have very much to begin with, and they had no family, friends, personal resources to draw on in the same way that other survivors that I've met since, you know, have. So actually their friends are wealthy. So their friend says, oh, well, come and stay in my spare room. You know, that woman is not, which is homeless, but she's not homeless sleeping on the streets in the same way that a woman who's got, you know, no family or friends to draw on is. So it's very hidden in lots of different ways. And, you know, I think a lot of that is linked to your own personal resources, your economic resources, but also the social resources that you have and which you can rely on as well, I would say equally important.
Wow, gosh, honestly, this is such a hard episode to record, because on it, like, my heart is just in my stomach just listening. The example that you shared about, first of all, the intersectionality, which is really interesting. That's a really interesting point, because, of course, it's compounded by existing inequalities. And then, you know, you've got this for some women who are experiencing this, to have this overlaid on top. It must make for, well, of course, you know, in all cases of abuse, you know, such a miserable experience. And I mean, I've got so many questions, but I suppose just to kind of to help people put this into context in terms of the impact, you know, in terms of what you're seeing in some of these women. I don't know whether in your experience it's showing up differently from other types of abuse, for example, physical abuse, for example, but in terms of some of the feelings that women in particular might have if they are sufferers of this type of abuse, what sorts of things are they? I mean, I can imagine, you know, off the top of my head, you know, you have this creeping sense of shame, perhaps, particularly if you were someone that, you know, you're to yourself, you're thinking, how did I find myself in this situation? Maybe denial. I mean, what else would you say?
Yeah, I think, again, because as a society, we tend to be quite victim blaming, actually. We say, well, why didn't you go? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you report to police? We don't say, actually, why did that perpetrator, that abuser behave in the way that they did? We don't put the responsibility onto the abuser or hold them accountable. So, you know, victims and survivors will internalise all of those things. They will feel shame because, again, there's these myths and stereotypes about who this happens to. And if you don't kind of tick that box, you think, you know, there's that the social shame, you know, what my friends, family, employer, you know, what will they think of me? I speak to women who feel quite stupid, who think, you know, I'm really intelligent, I should have seen this. Like, with hindsight, maybe they can see how the insidiousness happened, but of course, you know, they don't recognise it in the time. And I would always say, you know, we should always start a relationship with trust. It's very much something that I think, you know, you give to someone and they keep, you know, earning it, you know, to maintain it. So I would say, you're not stupid, you shouldn't feel stupid for kind of trusting the person that you love to have your best interests at heart. You really shouldn't. I think victims and survivors feel a great sense of isolation through all of those things. Quite often the abuser says no one will believe you, again, victims and survivors really sort of internalise that. They kind of see it played out, you know, sometimes quite publicly, that kind of lack of belief. So I think that's another piece, not having friends, family, colleagues to talk to, again, because of the sort of the shame and the stigma associated with that, not wanting to, you know, worsen your career prospects or to not seem to have a good understanding as you've sort of led people to believe. So I think there's all sort of reasons really, but economic abuse in the context that we're talking about will always be happening, certainly alongside emotional abuse. And I think, you know, that's really clear in some of the examples that I provided. You know, I've made reference to sexual abuse, but there'll also be, you know, likely physical abuse as well, because when a victim survivor kind of challenges these insidious forms of control, you know, quite often there might be a physical assault with the perpetrator saying, well, you know, if you challenge me, this is what I will do. And you only need to be assaulted once to start changing your behaviour to avoid being assaulted again. Survivors talk quite often about sort of treading on eggshells because they know what the repercussion could be, not kind of following the rules. And so therefore they kind of follow the rules, which sadly continually change. So they're never going to be able to prevent that, because that's what, you know, the abuser does. But they kind of know the repercussions of challenge and so sort of change the way that they behave, you know, as a consequence of that. So it's really difficult because, you know, they're being abused in lots of different ways.
Yeah, no, thank you for elaborating, though, because I think whilst it's such a difficult subject, I think it's really important for people to grasp not just what the hallmarks of financial and economic abuse look like, but also the impact, you know, what are sufferers of this form of abuse really facing? And you've talked about taking a survivor-led approach to tackling financial abuse. What does that mean?
So I think the first thing that means is starting with what feels safe for the victim or survivor. So again, as I said, you know, it's quite easy to say, well, you should do this and you should do that. But victims and survivors are kind of surviving every day in what are really, really sort of difficult situations. And they kind of are judging what's safe and how to behave, as I said. So, you know, they're kind of best equipped to make decisions. They shouldn't be told what to do. So, you know, as a friend or a family member or a colleague, it's about letting them know that you're there for them and that you will support them in whatever way you need to be support. They need to be supported. So really just being led by the victim and survivor and what they want, and considering the physical safety risks which are posed by the abuser. As I said, you know, considering the victim survivor's life circumstances. So again, that point about sort of multiple forms of discrimination, for example, kind of recognising it won't be so easy for some survivors, you know, to leave and to get a job, because, you know, they might not be employed because as a black woman, for example, they haven't got, as you know, there's racism within society, which means they're less likely to get a job than a white woman. So it's about kind of recognising that some of those solutions themselves, you know, are also going to be shaped by a context which is linked to their identity, and, you know, recognising that you'll need to provide a lot more support for victims and survivors with multiple inequalities than you will for women who don't experience multiple inequalities. Immigration status would be another example here. Victims and survivors with insecure immigration status and without leave to remain in the UK can't access welfare benefits in the same way that other victims and survivors can. So actually they face destitution if they leave the abuser, you know, so that, you know, creates a different context within which these decisions are made. They can't access a refuge space, so they can't access safe accommodation. All of these kind of factors will shape, you know, how they're responded to. It's about kind of, again, centering the victim survivor's long-term plans as well. So you might say, well, in the short term, you know, do this. It might be that you're in a lot of debt, you should declare bankruptcy, you know, that's the best way of dealing with that. But again, you know, if you want a career in financial services, or you've had a career in financial services, you don't necessarily want to go down a bankruptcy route. So you just need to think about what kind of the future ambitions for victims and survivors are. And also just to kind of recognise sometimes that their decision making might not seem logical in some ways. So again, we talk to money and debt advisors who say, well, you know, if someone hasn't got much money, they ought to prioritise their debt. So they go into priority debt straight away. Well, a priority debt wouldn't be a catalogue debt. But a victim survivor who hasn't got access to any money and needs clothes for them or their children might be relying on that catalogue in order to clothe themselves. So actually it's more important for them to pay the catalogue debt than it might be for them to pay the electricity bill, which would be seen as the priority debt, because actually, you know, they kind of need certain types of credit in order to survive. So it's kind of really recognising their situation and kind of being led by them and trying to think of all of these things when you're providing that support. But, you know, ultimately, I think going back to that point that victims and survivors are the strongest people I know because they are surviving this. They're not stupid. This is why it can happen to anybody. And kind of respecting that as a starting point and kind of offering your support, but not telling people what to do.
Yeah, I love that, Nicola, because I mean, what I'm hearing is, as you would expect with any form of charity that's working to support survivors of abuse, you're trying to offer help, but without that judgment, without embedding any further shame, and really being led by what works best. But also the thing that's quite interesting in what you say is that there isn't a prescribed formula. And, you know, sometimes you see with certain types of, I don't know, remedial therapies or trauma-based techniques, etc. And of course, there's a vast array of them, but some of them can look as though they're following a prescribed formula, and you say this and then you do that and then you offer this, the end, versus, you know, what you are offering through SEA and thinking, you know, specifically about the individual circumstances, which I'm sure makes for a far more, not only, you know, a comprehensive assessment of what's happening and how best you can help, but also it must feel much better for the person on the receiving end, the person that's suffering this, to feel that they do have some control in all other aspects, feeling like they're out of control, but in this situation, that they are actively involved in how they're going to survive this. And exactly as you say, you know, these are women that, if you've been suffering this form of abuse, your survival instincts have already had to kick in, perhaps to protect children, perhaps to protect yourself from, you know, the abuse getting even worse. And so those different parts of your brain are already firing up and thinking, you know, what can I do to not just resist, but to reduce the impact and to just make sure that I can survive. So I love this approach that you've taken. It sounds, for anybody listening, it just sounds like the right environment from which you can thrive. And, you know, as you say, you know, survive and rebuild your life afterwards. So earlier on in the conversation, you talked about having maybe a sympathetic employer, or, you know, thinking about some of the policy level interventions. I don't know whether you were saying that you'd like to see, or that, you know, that are already in place around economic abuse. But if you had a magic wand and you were able to say, right, this is how, because ultimately it probably requires a multi-agency approach to really achieving the best possible outcomes for someone that might be suffering. And that might include, you know, for people that are employed, having the employer involved and aware of what's happening so that they can be part of it. Maybe, you know, having some government level interventions too, so that perpetrators are prosecuted. And also, I suppose, family and friends as well. But, you know, if you had a magic wand, what would you like to see? Who would you say the different institutions that you would typically expect to be involved, or that would be, without them necessarily realizing it, that have a vested interest or a role to play in tackling this form of abuse?
It's a really interesting question, because I talk, I guess, about who I consider to be kind of the traditional stakeholders. So, you know, that kind of response to domestic abuse for years was a criminal justice response. That was all the criminal justice agencies. A recognition that statutory agencies more broadly, for example, housing or social services, needed to understand the issue. You know, then we recognise that actually victims and survivors, again, for a whole host of reasons, might not trust statutory agencies, including the criminal justice system. And that, again, goes back to the identities of victims and survivors and what it means to report to the police. You know, if you do have insecure immigration status, what does that mean? Or what does it mean if the police are institutionally racist and you are, in some ways, kind of reporting someone who they would expect to be a perpetrator, and or you wouldn't get a great response yourself? So, you know, for very, very many reasons, a lot of victims and survivors don't trust, you know, statutory agencies. And the abuser is likely to say, you know, if you go to social services, they'll take the children away. And, you know, they'll create a sort of a lot of fear. So that's sort of the incredible importance in many ways of charities and the voluntary sector, because, you know, there is that kind of support and it's survivor centres, and there's a recognition of how domestic abuse operates, and an importance also on safety, because again, a lot of statutory agencies who don't understand the issue will make suggestions or do things which, you know, aren't always safe. But so then it kind of goes back to actually that societal response. Actually, it is everybody. So yeah, it might be an employer, but it might also be a financial services firm. So it might be your bank or building society. And one of the things that surviving economic abuse that we've done is kind of expand on what, as they call those traditional stakeholders, and said, you know, the non-traditional stakeholders are the financial services firms. They are the money and debt advice organisations, because actually those are the places where victims and survivors are more likely to disclose, but they're most likely to disclose to friends and family. So, you know, basically what you're doing then is saying that everybody in society actually needs to respond to this issue. It takes me sort of back to your previous point about how we respond to victims and survivors, because this is allowed to happen because society lets it. So we have to have a societal solution that holds perpetrators accountable and supports victims and survivors. I think that's really, really important. So, you know, even as a friend or a family member or a colleague, you know, you can make a huge, huge difference. So it's really about kind of recognising that this is a societal issue. This is not something that is linked to the individual. It's nothing about them, their behaviour, their sort of psyche. It's not going to be sorted through, you know, some kind of like dealing with a deficit in them in terms of psychological counselling. You're not going to be able to stop perpetrators through counselling them, because sadly, if it was that easy, we'd have done it already. It's because society allows them to do it. It gives them the power. They use structures and processes which we don't challenge, that we don't shut down. So unless we deal with it as a society, because it's a societal issue, we're never going to end domestic abuse. So that's quite a tall order. That's why, you know, this work has been done since the early 70s. And why we're still going, and why sadly 2 women a week are still being killed by a current or a former partner, and why around 10 women a week are still taking their lives, because, you know, these figures have not changed. You know, the 20 years that I've been working in the domestic abuse sector, these things have not changed, because we have not, as society, done what we need to do. But, you know, we don't tolerate this in any shape or form, and that we're better at recognising it, challenging it, and supporting survivors.
Wow. My goodness. Nicola, I'm thinking about your background and what inspired you, not just to start SEA, but, you know, you've had a career in working with survivors in different forms of abuse as well. What inspired you to get into that, you know, this area of work, and then to start SEA itself?
I mean, there's still all the sort of the obvious things, like seeing the physical harm caused to survivors, the poverty, you know, the difficulties that they face on a day-to-day basis. But I think for me, it was mostly about how what they'd experienced led them not to be able to fulfill or achieve their potential. So, you know, if they hadn't met someone who stopped them from studying or going to work, what would they have gone on to do? What would they have achieved? If they were flourishing in a career, coerced them into so much debt that they spend the rest of their life actually working just to pay that back, meaning that their kind of quality of life in the here and now is in some ways constrained in the same way that the abuser constrained them when they were with the abuser, but it just takes a different form when they leave, because the repercussions and the opportunities lost, I guess, still like constrain them in a way that the perpetrator did. So I'm thinking of a survivor who spoke to me really recently, where she said, you know, she had left the abuser, you know, she wasn't allowed to have friends and family. She, you know, was physically assaulted a lot of the time. You know, he'd coerced her into a lot of debt, and she'd had to move back in with her parents, and she was basically having to borrow money from them to put petrol in her car to go to work. But her work was a really high paid job, but because of all the outgoings that she had, she was literally working just to pay all of that back. She didn't have disposable income to go and see the friends and family she could now see, because she wasn't being prevented by the abuser from seeing them, but she couldn't afford to go out and do things with them. So in some ways, you know, her life still remained really sort of small, and she wasn't able to live it in the way that she wanted to. So for me, it's about that kind of loss of potential, that inability to pursue ambitions, to live the kind of life that you want and deserve to live. Also how you can't even really give back to society when you're in that situation. So for me, it just felt so unfair and just so unjust. And because that could be you or me, you know, it becomes very personal, actually. I haven't experienced abuse myself. A lot of people sometimes think I do, but I don't see a difference between those who have experienced abuse and those who don't, because we're all, you know, to our point about being disproportionately impacted, we're all women, and this could happen to any one of us. So I kind of see this, you know, it's a bit of a sisterhood. It's a bit of a, I'm just lucky I didn't meet someone who sought to control me in that way.
That's such a powerful response, Nicola. Thank you. And I mean, I hadn't thought of it from that perspective, but you're quite right. it's the cost and the opportunity cost in particular. You know, what else could these women potentially have gone on to do if they hadn't been encumbered by huge amounts of crippling debt, for example, or now a stigma or these feelings of shame or self-loathing or whatever that are associated with being subject to this kind of abuse and feeling powerless to do anything about it. So yeah, such a brilliant response. And so one of the things that always comes up in my mind when I talk about this, particularly when, you know, with debt being one of the main tools, main weapons used against women that are suffering this form of abuse, what's the law on financial or economic abuse? Has it changed? Has it always been there and we were just completely unaware?
So a combination of all of those things, Davinia. So some behaviours have always been criminal. So thinking about fraud, for example, or sort of damage to property. But I guess what differentiates them from where we are now is that they were seen as specific incidents. You know, you prosecute a particular incident in time, you know, that car that was destroyed or that loan that was taken out without someone's knowledge. Their incidents of abuse. But I'm hoping that listeners will have recognised that this is like a pattern of behaviour, that economic abuse is kind of interwoven with this kind of emotional abuse, you know, physical sexual abuse, tactics like isolation, intimidation. Victims and survivors don't see these things all as separate incidents happening one or the other. That is just this all-encompassing context within which they live and which they're fearful within. So in 2015, the criminal law kind of recognised that and introduced something called the controlling or coercive behaviour offence. So that recognised that there are patterns of behaviour. So acts which aren't criminal in and of themselves when perpetrated within this context and have an adverse impact on a victim or a survivor, they then become criminal. So that has been sort of amazing because it kind of reflects the reality of victims and survivors. Doesn't necessarily work well. And actually Surviving Economic Abuse is launching a report early in September, which is talking about all the ways it doesn't work well and how it needs to be improved. But it's certainly a starting point. And one of the things that the charity has done in 2021 was to lobby government to include economic abuse actually within the definition of domestic abuse. So the controlling or coercive behaviour offence was really introduced to kind of capture those kind of incidents that weren't criminal and were often quite psychologically motivated, like psychological abuse. And at the time, they didn't recognise that actually it was capturing different forms of economic abuse as well. So we did an initial piece of research which kind of showed how economic abuse was featuring within the controlling or coercive behaviour offence. And we said, look, you know, it's there, so you need to kind of name it within your definition of domestic abuse. Which then led to guidance for the Crown Prosecution Service and for the police and for statutory agencies to be updated because they didn't formally recognise economic abuse as a form of domestic abuse. So by naming it within legislation and defining it within legislation, people are starting to look out for those signs alongside all the other signs that I've talked about. So it just means that we'll see kind of more recognition in terms of criminal justice responses, but also in terms of, you know, the response by any agency that is in contact with a victim or survivor as well. So we've come a long way. I mean, back in the 1970s, there was no legislation around domestic abuse at all. And that probably explains why it's been such a criminal sort of justice focus for so long. But to that point about society, you know, it needs to be more than just the law. There's, you know, different forms of justice for victims and survivors, and actually to have voice for society to recognise their experience and the impact it's had, for society to hold perpetrators accountable, is justice in another sense. So, you know, justice operates in lots of different ways for victims and survivors.
And so thinking about the broader role society can play, and if you, and you know, each of us as individual agents in society with the power to effect change, to call things out, to advocate, I'm thinking about relationships, and we know the relationship between the correlation between finance, obviously control, your romantic relationships as well, and the success or failure of them, the role that money can play in the success or failure of a relationship, even with all things being equal, you know, so in a very neutral relationship in which both parties have equal power and control, you know, money problems can really be a source of contention. And so I'm just thinking about how we can each of us be more, if not vigilant, just more alert, more aware in calling out behaviours or intervening in positive ways, which is quite a difficult thing to do. I mean, if I imagine, you know, my best friend who's married, if I were to say, gosh, that looks a bit strange, or, you know, if I go to their house for, you know, to see the kids or for a play date or whatever, how do you practically call out some of the things? It may not even be calling out behaviours that you actually see happening, but just certain things that you feel uncomfortable or uneasy about. What can we do to be vigilant and to intervene in an appropriate way? It's quite hard, I imagine.
Well, I mean, it is hard, but then at the same time, it's easy. So I think what we need to start doing is kind of normalising conversations. One of the things about abuse is that people don't talk about it. And that's why, you know, there is that shame and that stigma. So if we can start breaking down the taboos around the issue and talk about it, then that's got to be positive. Similarly, we don't talk about money. And, you know, they're kind of, you know, if you take not talking about abuse and you take not talking about money and you try and talk about economic abuse, you know, you're talking about sort of two areas that people just generally don't talk about. So it's about kind of normalising those behaviours. I've spoken to a lot of victims and survivors who say actually that they've recognised the abuse they've experienced only when they've actually told somebody else about it. So I think it's not to be kind of afraid to say things, you know, and you could do it in the nicest of ways. You could say something like, I'm worried about you. You have given up a job that you love. I'm really interested in why you've done that. Or I've noticed you haven't bought any new clothes for the last 12 months. You know, why is that? And I think sometimes when victims and survivors might talk about that, it might help, you know, I know it helps them recognise actually what is happening to them. So I think, you know, to normalise those conversations, to kind of make it okay, to help victims and survivors kind of unpick their experiences. And then, as I said earlier, just to say, well, actually, I'm here to support you. Did you know that, you know, there are charities that help, or did you know that the police can do something? So to be educated yourself about what can be done means that you can kind of provide those tools and the resources to victims and survivors. So kind of going back to that kind of common thread, you know, you're not telling them what to do, because you really hit the nail on the head, Davinia, when you talked about it's really important that they stay in control, because they have been controlled by somebody else. They've been told they can't do anything on their own. So give them back the control, support them to do what they want to do, and give them the tools and the resources and the space and the support to be able to do it. And certainly surviving economic abuse, we have something called Sea Champions, and anyone is welcome to be a Sea Champion. You just need to sign up on our website. And we just ask you to do two or three things, like a month, just to make a difference. It might be retweeting something that we put out. I can't even say retweeting anymore, can I? I should just say something. I
think
Something from any social media channel, for example. You know, it could be talking to friends and family. Lots of like really small actions that you can take. But if we all start taking these small actions, and we can all create a huge amount of difference together.
First of all, I need to sign up to be a Sea Champion. That's the first. I mean, I should have been one already, so that's embarrassing. So that's my action following this episode. But I loved what you said about actually, in response, brilliant rebuttal to me saying it's hard, actually normalising conversations about money in general, and then just normalising conversations about all sorts of things. I mean, you know, one of the, you know, we say all the time, quite lightly, that, you know, women, there's a lot of data and research to point to the fact that women are happier, probably understandably, talking about our sex lives than about our bank balances, for example, with people that we're really close to. And so being able to have what are arguably viewed as hard conversations should just be a natural extension of that. You know, if you're close to someone and you're able to have intimate conversations, that we shouldn't shy away from something that could ultimately impact someone's long-term and even short-term well-being. So yeah, brilliant, brilliant response. So Nicola, in the final part of this interview, because I really feel like this could be like a whole documentary series, but I'm really interested in your personal relationship with money. So how would you describe your relationship with money and how it's evolved over time?
I would say I probably don't have one. I was never educated about money. It's probably through my work on economic abuse that I've kind of recognise this whole other world that exists. I've worked in the charity sector forever. I'm used to be paid not very much money, to be focused on bringing money in to keep a charity going. So I probably don't have one. And as I say, it's through this work that it's kind of started to encourage me to start thinking about that, actually.
Yeah, and I can imagine that. And thinking about, you know, how you wield power financially, even if you don't think that you are or have that ability. And so one of the things that I always talk about with the Rainmakers are some of the different ways that we are enriched in our lives outside of just financial wealth, because I know this is one of the things that it can be a real sticking point for lots of people, irrespective of earnings, actually. I mean, one of the things that hopefully has been made clear during this interview, or during this conversation, is that there are women at all different levels on the income spectrum who are still impacted, perhaps in the same way, by, you know, economic abuse. And so having huge amounts, seemingly having huge amounts of financial wealth, doesn't necessarily lend itself to happiness automatically. So we always talk about what it means to be a wealthy woman and the different ways that wealth can manifest itself. How would you describe wealth in your life? You know, what does being a wealthy woman mean to you?
I think for me, it goes back to the freedom piece. So being able to live the life that you want to.
Yeah. Yeah. Simple and totally spot on. And then, you know, my final question, we always talk about investing at Raincheck. Of course, that's one of the things that lots of women who find me come to me about. You know, perhaps they want to start their investing journey, perhaps they feel a bit uncertain about where to begin or with investments that they've currently got. And I always start by saying that we are, each of us, our biggest investment by far. Everything that we've done to get to this point, our education, our careers, the families that we are building, you know, how we interact with other people, etc., we're investing all the time in ourselves and in others. What would you say, Nicola, has been your biggest investment in yourself? Because I think as women, it's easy for us to identify, you know, in your work, it's easy, super easy for you to identify the investment that you make in other people and in society as a whole. But what would you say has been your biggest investment in yourself? And how would you say it's transformed or impacted you?
I would say it is education. I mean, that in and of itself isn't always helpful. I guess it's kind of the knowledge that you take from it. And I think for me, that's been transformative because I've kind of learned about issues that need a response. You asked me a little bit earlier, I don't think I actually answered the question about kind of what got me into this area in the first place. And that was because I kind of thought that people in different parts of the world had problems, and I didn't think there was a problem in my own country. So I started in the international development space and visited lots of communities where, you know, you kind of go in with preconceived ideas about what human rights issues are going to be uncovered, and you kind of wait for people to say, well, I don't have access to water, or I don't have access to education, or something that you would just, I don't know, as I say, it's just something, you know, my own stereotypes, I guess, you know, were challenged. And I would also say travel alongside education. Like, I've always, like, for me, travel and new experiences and talking to new people and kind of opening my mind and recognizing different ways of doing things has been kind of equally important in all of this, and has also helped kind of build resilience. But every community I went to, whoever you spoke to, certainly women and children, talked about violence, and I was just like, okay, wasn't expecting that. And then I came across a domestic abuse charity one day, and I was like, oh my god, this happens here. And I had no idea. It sounds really silly.
It must have been such a humbling experience, though, because you're right, it forces you to confront your own, I don't know, preconceptions, misconceptions.
Yeah, and also like having quite a charmed life that I should never have been, you know, I kind of heard about domestic abuse, but it happened to other people. It was just physical abuse. You know, I kind of dismissed it. I didn't take it seriously. No one had ever educated me on it. So I think, you know, that realization that I was kind of running around the world when actually this was happening to my friends, to my family, to my colleagues, but I'd never even thought to look to see if that might be the case or to ask if that was the case. It just made me think, you know, I just need to do something transformative about my everyday, I guess. And that's what got me into it. It was just a real awakening. And as I say, you know, the more knowledge you have and the more you understand about the issue and the impact it does have, just becomes a kind of a passion, a cause. There was nothing about economic abuse that was known when I started the charity. So I'd done some research back in 2006, which was the first research around economic abuse, because there was just no research that existed and no practice responses. And that just blew my mind. You know, this has been happening forever. And yet as a society, we just weren't doing anything. So there was that piece around domestic abuse broadly, the bit about economic abuse specifically. And I think that kind of realisation when it became personal that, you know, it was unjust, it was unfair, we can all do something about that. And that just kind of created a real passion. So, it, you know, it's part of me. It's not something that I go to work and do. It's those injustices and that society that we live in, that much to my husband's embarrassment sometimes, I challenge all the time. Because if we don't challenge it, how are we going to change it?
Yeah, exactly. I love how you have articulated that, particularly, you know, as women, there are certain points in your life, actually, where maybe you do find yourself floundering a bit or feeling a bit lost. But the idea of an awakening, I love that. But also the contribution that we can make, the contribution that we can all make to doing something, to calling out injustice, it, however micro or macro the situation. And so thank you for all of the amazing work that you have done. I think at this point, it's probably a good opportunity for us to perhaps share resources, you know, where people might be able to find out more about surviving economic abuse, where people should be, you know, what should be people's first step if they're looking for support and help? What resources are available?
So the Surviving Economic Abuse website is www.survivingeconomicabuse.org. And so there's a kind of click I need help button. We're not a frontline service ourselves, but we support frontline services to respond to economic abuse. And we take their kind of evidence and, you know, we work out what the issues are and we create that kind of policy change so that more people benefit than the individual. So we've got information there about, you know, banks or building societies you can talk to, domestic abuse charities that can help, a financial support line that our frontline partner Money Advice Plus runs. So lots of information there for victims and survivors. We do work alongside victims and survivors in everything that we do because we need to be, you know, fully grounded in what makes a difference for them. So we also work with a group of victims and survivors who we call the experts by experience. And we've developed a number of resources with them. So there's kind of written resources about, you know, how to approach your bank or, you know, information about housing, for example, an issue you might have with a mortgage. So the kind of the issues and challenges that are brought to our attention through those kind of frontline service providers and via victims and survivors themselves, you know, are things that we kind of prioritise in terms of developing resources to help as many people as possible. And then we have a piece about I'm supporting someone. So if you're in a role, and that could be as a friend or a family member or as a colleague, resources about how you do that as well, because that's been a real strong theme of this conversation, definitely. And then, yeah, as I said, you know, information about what you can do as an individual. So, you know, signing up to our newsletter, becoming a Sea Champion, perhaps wanting to give money to the charity and support our work in that way. Obviously, you know, we do rely on charitable donations, so, you know, we can't do our work without it. So many different ways that you can get support as an individual, as someone who's supporting someone else, or if you want to kind of support the actual work that we do and make that change in society, there's lots of different ways of doing that via the website as well.
Brilliant. So I will share access to all of the information in the show notes. Nicola, thank you so much for your time today and for a brilliant conversation. I hope that it has planted the seed in people's minds about some of the things to look out for and also, I guess, help to start the conversation for anybody that needs that conversation started. Brilliant, brilliant discussion. And hopefully we can have more of these discussions in the coming years and months. I'm sure we will be doing so. Thank you so much for your time today and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. And, you know, thanks for bringing this conversation into this space, because as you say, you know, the more that we have, the more difference we're going to make. And I really appreciate the platform that you provided. So thank you.
Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how Raincheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at Raincheck and don't forget to share, like, rate, review and subscribe. See you next time.